Are you a big brain of the beautiful game? Prove it with the great new app that'll test your football knowledge to the limit. Name That Player. Download the Name That Player app today and race against the clock to identify the Premier League players purely from a list of the clubs they've played for. Put your football knowledge to the ultimate test with the Name That Player app. Available right now for iOS and Android from the App Store and Google Play. Name That Player. Can you beat the best?
Shoot the defence, the best podcast in the world. We're at it.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. I'm your host, Stel, and I'm joined by my co-host this evening, Mr. Mike Pieri. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good, Stel. You?
Yeah, I'm good. How are you coping with this COVID-19 thing? Are you being a teacher at home?
It's tough. I mean, coping is, I think, the right word. Just coping, I think.
Is that the best you've got? Come on now. I thought you'd have a couple of stories for me. Nothing at all.
Then being a teacher and having to do homeschool, it's a completely different world. I'd rather be in school rather than having to teach my own kids.
Oh, go on.
what can I say? I've got two kids, so the youngest, he's pretty much all right. But when I say to him, have you done your maths, have you done your English, I get the roll of the eyes. You know, I can't send him to the duty manager. I can't give him any attention, whereas at school I can.
Yeah, but detentions are what mums are for, no?
No, I've been given sole responsibility for home learning.
Oh, so, mate.
Tastes on me, unfortunately. Unfortunately.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, I'm glad you're surviving. That's the main thing, yeah. Brilliant. Well, our guest this evening for our feature, My Top 5 Matches, is a UEFA A licensed coach. He's the author of Coaching Youth Football, Making the Ball Roll, and Deliberate Soccer Practice. It's Ray Power. Welcome to the show, Ray. How you doing?
Hi, Estelle. Hi, Mike. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Absolute pleasure, mate. How are you coping, sir?
Yeah, I am. I don't know. It's kind of starting to normalise a little bit, I think. And that's kind of a big issue, I think. I think normal life is going to be pretty hard to resume whenever that does happen here. I've kind of busied myself personally. I've got three kids kind of inside all day as well, between sort of 1 and 15. So it's everyone's on top of each other. Everyone's, you know, raring to get out and do something a little bit more, I don't know, out of the box than we have been doing. But it got a little bit close to home. My wife, she's a carer. She had a test. I think when we first went to schedule this interview, we had to postpone it because of that. So for a brief moment, it got very close to home. But thankfully came back negative. And it's a different feeling when it's, you know, sometimes when it's someone else, somewhere else, it kind of doesn't feel real. But when it was on your doorstep, it certainly did feel real. So thankfully all that has come and gone. Listen, we've been asked to stay indoors with some Wi-Fi and 800 TV channels, so hopefully it subsides and everyone will be all right.
Fingers crossed, eh? Fingers crossed.
Yeah, too right.
Okay, well, let's go with your top five matches, and we'll begin with Liverpool against Milan in the 2005 Champions League final, a match where most Liverpool fans, all Liverpool fans, love to talk about, whereas as a United fan, it's this one. So Liverpool have gone 3-0 down at half-time against a very, very, very good Milan side with the likes of Kaká and Crespo, Sam, Maldini. The list of names is absolutely endless.
Super team.
There you go. And at half-time, Liverpool fans are singing You'll Never Walk Alone, something that surely boosted the Liverpool players. And the rest is history, so to speak. So, Ray, why this one?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm a Liverpool fan, but with regards to football, I kind of carry several hats. I'm a football fan when it comes to Liverpool and Ireland and what have you. I get caught up in the drama like anyone else does, even if it's not my team that's playing. But I also have a coach's hat on, my professional hat on, which is it makes you look at games differently and makes you look at them in a different way than the supporters would. So me looking back on that game as a supporter, I was in my early 20s at the time without my sort of coaching background. It was depths of despair at halftime and elation and, you know, kind of madness, whatever that was an hour later, when it all turned round. Looking back on the game, I heard one of your other guests, Thor, speak about this game in very tactical terms, in terms of the changes that were made at halftime and stuff like that. I think for me as a coach, this game told me that anything's possible in a football game. And I know that there's been other comebacks, and you've got United in 99, and even Newcastle came back from 4-0 down, I think, against Arsenal, didn't they, in the Premier League?
Yeah.
I think it was a very, very late 4-0 to 4-all in an AFCON or something like that as well. So these are littered, but it just, there was no possible way this was supposed to happen at halftime. No matter what was said or done at halftime, this wasn't supposed to be possible. And although the halftime is kind of seen as the conduit for that change, when you watch the game back, you know, early in the second half, Milan had a couple of moments and it could have gone four quite easily. And I think when we talk about these games with my coach's hat on, you do come back to those little moments that kind of change things. And yes, tactically, they had to get hold of Kaká and they had to threaten Pirlo on the other side a little bit more. But there's nothing like that little boost of energy that you get from scoring an early goal. The worrying thing for me is that usually when you come back from 3-0 down, you score early and then you rally late on, and you hope to get to sort of 3-2 with some time to spare. Liverpool got the 3-all and there was still 30 minutes left in normal time. So it was, a whole range of emotions, and then looking back on it, I think it was literally impossible. Even watching it back, you know the story and you think how. There's a double save from Jerzy Dudek from Shevchenko in extra time. There's, you know, Carragher and people like that are on their knees physically. A mismatch of a team on the pitch, a mismatch of a formation. It was just, a perfect storm in the end.
Mm. Well, before I let Mike ask his question to you, I've got one that I'm going to post to you, that one I already posted to Thor during our podcast. Now, Liverpool are 3-0 up at half-time. And Ancelotti, being a fantastic head coach that he is, are you surprised that he didn't make any changes to hold on to that lead? Because they didn't make any substitutions or any tactical switches at half-time. But Thor said, well, you know, Liverpool played with wing-backs in the second half and got at Milan down the flanks because they were playing very narrow. So what would you have done if you're Ancelotti?
Well, they had that diamond, which served them so well, let's be honest. And yes, Sergiño came on late in the game to give him some sort of a natural width. And I believe Maldini played left back that night as well, which kind of narrows them up even further. So I don't know. I'd love to ask him to. Actually, the game that we're going to finish on is kind of my version of looking back at some moments and going, damn, I wish I'd have done that.
Right.
And I do wonder if he had, if he could do it all over again, so to speak, whether he would have tweaked something or changed something, or whether you just kind of got carried away in the tide. And by the time, you know, the damage was done, it went from 3-0 to 3-3 in 6 minutes. And before Gerrard scored, I don't think there was a massive sign that it was going to happen. And then obviously, you know, if you turn around in 6 minutes, you don't have a lot of thinking time. Potentially, I'm reading between the lines. Maybe if you could catapult him back in time, he would have an answer for you. They should have won that game, you know, regardless. Mm. There was 30 minutes left that they largely bossed, certainly extra time. They had chances. As I said, even before Liverpool scored, even before Gerrard scored the first one, they had. It was just like a carry on from the first half. They had a couple of chances, and I don't think anyone's seen it coming, even early second half. So I'm going to let them off the hook a little bit. And I'm not buying into the, you know, Italians are quite clinical when it comes to their football. So I'm certainly not buying into the, you know, parading the trophy at halftime kind of stuff either. I just think it was, from Liverpool's point of view, just a perfect storm and a kind of a perfect fairy tale, random football story that'll never happen again, I'm sure.
Mm. And it would take something tragic for Berlusconi to cancel one of his famous parties, and I'm sure he cancelled one that night.
Sure. You know. I'm sure, yeah, definitely don't know anything about that stuff.
On the note, Mike.
Just from a coaching point of view, again, obviously because you're a coach, you've written books, you've got your A licence. When I look at that Milan team, when I look at the Liverpool team, I mean, you alluded to it earlier, just looking on paper. But if you look beyond just the abilities of the players, I'm looking at AC Milan's team. I'm looking at leaders. You've got Cafu, you've got Stam, Nesta, Maldini, Gattuso, Pirlo, you know, leaders, true leaders, big players. Whereas Liverpool don't have as many as that. Now, you did say, obviously, that Liverpool scored their three goals in about 6 or 7 minutes. Mentally, as a coach and as players as well, what's happening to those leaders during those 6 minutes and during the match, but also after the fact that half time the game's pretty much done and dusted? But from a mental point of view, how do you account for that during the game, which I think you've sort of answered, but from a mental point of view, but also after, what would you do after to help these players?
I don't know where to start. I mean, afterwards, I don't know if you can do anything but walk away from that and literally put it to bed. I don't think you can. It's kind of like analysing something that, it's like analysing a car crash that you've seen, and you know what happened, you know who was responsible, you know all the details, but it still happened. And you know, sometimes you, as a coach, you analyse games and you pick out little nuggets that will help because you're getting something fresh. I don't think to this day any of those AC Milan players need to be told anything they don't already know about that game. And I believe this, and this is kind of the point of not only being a Liverpool fan, but why this game is in my five, is exactly because of this mental side of it, and the fact that you can turn around to anyone at any point, no matter how bad a game is going or how well a game is going, and saying, look, this happened, this was real, this was the Champions League final, by the way, these were these players, you know, that AC Milan team was just, as a 1-11, was astonishing in terms of their level and ability. You're right, compared to the Liverpool team, it's night and day, on paper and everywhere else. In the game, it was night and day. But they found a way, they stuck at it, they showed a bit of bravery. I don't think if you spoke to too many of those players now, the Milan ones, anytime I see them talk about it, they still don't know what happened. They still can't quite get their head around it. And if I'm Ancelotti after that game, I think it's, come on, let's get out of here. You know, let's get out of here and let's have a couple of days and then we'll figure the rest out.
Mm.
I know that doesn't sound very scientific. I know that doesn't sound very kind of solve the problem, but I think it's that big a deal on such a big stage, the biggest of stages. I think it's one of them you walk away from, and you've learned your lesson. No one needs to tell you your lessons from that. So that would be me at least.
Yeah, I remember Gattuso's comments prior to the 2007 final between the two. You know, he was saying the final was going to be different. I promise. You know, and you could tell that result and the performance and the comeback obviously hurt Milan, the players especially. So, yeah, it's a pivotal moment in both teams' history, I guess.
Yeah, Liverpool were way better value for winning that game, to be fair, 2 years later. But, such is the game we love, I guess.
Mm, absolutely. Okay, on to the next game. Let's go to 1995, a famous victory for Ajax at the Bernabeu against Real Madrid. A 2-0 win. Goals from Jari Littmanen and Patrick Cliver. So, why this one, my friend?
I don't know, I think most coaches would relate to this, that you kind of, and maybe fans as well, to be fair, you kind of up going down some rabbit holes when you're studying football, tactics and coaches and famous coaches and famous teams. And I think it was a combination of the kind of Cruyff to Guardiola coaching pathway. And a thing in a book from about Marcelo Bielsa that referred to this this Ajax team, and you know, it kind of goes down in history. It's a young team. It plays in you know, the kind of throwback to total football kind of way, and I wanted to see it. And I watched they won the Champions League final a few months before this game against Milan, actually, and the games of on YouTube, and it's quite scruffy, and you're kind of looking at it going, this isn't kind of what I read about, this isn't kind of what I expected. And so you scratch the surface a little more, and Louis van Gaal calls this game away to Real Madrid a few months later in the Champions League the most perfect game he's played, or his team has played. And when you watch it with the coaches on, it is quite astonishing. They've gone to the Bernabeu and made Real Madrid, no matter who, you know, what kind of team Madrid had, they made him look like the away team. They made it look like they were playing a completely different game, which was, you know, really, really impressive. Edgar Davids played a kind of a hybrid central midfielder, left-back, attacking midfielder, wing-back, kind of all-in-one. And just it really pushed the boundaries to how a lot of people think of tactics, which can be a little bit, you play there and you play in a straight line and your mate plays there, and you know, the whole Sky Sports, we're playing 4-4-2 today and it's all very, you know, structured, whereas this was really quite fluid. They played a 3-3-3-1, I guess, but the it was 2-0 and a scoreline, but it could have been 6 or 7. It was that impressive, and they didn't score till quite late in the second half either. So it was, they blew me away. A lot of the individuals blew me away as well.
The build up play to Lippmann's goal was fantastic, absolutely incredible.
Absolutely, yeah, and even if the finish was quite a, you know, it's a nice little ball in, but the finish, I guess, is the easy part. Mm. So you look at it maybe in a highlight reel and you think, oh, that's not so impressive, but you watch that build up and you watch it in the context of that team and how young they were, how different they played the game, how they stuck to their principles in terms of wanting to get the ball down. And like of Overmars, he was in his early Keith Clivert, who I think was still a teenager, even Lippmann, what I don't think was in his mid-20s either. So you had this De Boer and Daley Blind and Van der Sar. It was just Michael Reisley, Edgar Davids. You keep going on and on and you think, well, what a Fellini George, what a team to kind of come together. And Louis van Gaal has his detractors long before his kind of stint at Man United about kind of not really getting on board with creative players sometimes or mavericks, but you know, whatever Midas touch he used to bring all that together at the same time was phenomenal.
That's right. And Mike, although it wasn't a star-studded Real Madrid side that we're kind of used to, or the Galacticos as the younger, well, this kind of generation calls them nowadays, this Ajax side was fantastic, as Ray said. But then again, we had Van Gaal as manager at United, and the Van Gaal we knew in the 90s played far more expansive football, didn't he? Why do you think he went very negative when it came to United?
I just think simply that he just didn't have the players that he wanted to implement his ideals, which is why he pigeonholed a lot of players into spaces and areas and say, you can only play in this area. Whereas the Ajax team, they were quite fluid because he trusted these young players because they were better players. I mean, that said, I mean, they played against a Real Madrid team that, you know, Redondo, Raul, Luis Enrique, he had, you know, Zamorano and Michael Laudrup. That's a formidable set of players there. But this Ajax team were something special.
And they had a central defender who we were looking on YouTube before, or on Wikipedia and whatnot. We thought, hang about, is it the same guy that we think it is? Kike Sanchez Flores, the centre back, has the Watford manager.
That's right. Yeah, I'm pretty sure he was a fullback, but he must have. He played centre half in this game. So I don't know if anyone was injured. I can't remember if anyone was injured.
Oh, there you go. See, we tried to do our research, right?
He came actually on for Michael Laudrup, and he was. I remember him, you know, growing up and watching him in the Spain teams who weren't that successful in the 90s. And that's a Michel. I thought he was a fantastic player.
Yep.
Really good footballer.
Yeah, I think it's one of them games where I won't say the opposition become irrelevant, because there's definitely a context around being away to Real Madrid in the Bernabeu, no matter when that happens, or if they did have household names, as you listed there, but maybe not the kind of powerhouse and not European champions. But you go there largely as a bunch of kids, you know, expect to have the game. You don't expect to have the run of the game, and they were applauded off in the end because of how they approached playing the game of football, and that's what attracted me to probing this game. I couldn't tell you who was injured, who missed games, who should have been in there, or who was on the bench that should have came on, or anything like that. It was just a case of kind of sitting back and trying to unpick this kind of dynamic team, and just to go back to the point you made about Van Gaal at United, Van Gaal's always been a structured guy, and I think I don't think it was ever the case, even with that Ajax team, where it was, you know, do whatever you want sort of thing, but it certainly looked a lot different than United did, and I remember his United team going to Anfield. And I think they won 2-0, but they bossed it that day. It looked like a Barcelona or a Bayern Munich that he had, or an Ajax he had that particular day. But I think it got in. The Man United school of attacking is width and go forward early and put teams on the back foot. Whereas I think Van Gaal's version of attacking at the time was keep the ball until the right moment opens up, which kind of, I guess, caused a bit of a divide between both.
Can I ask a question, Ray, about this game? From a coaching point of view, this is a really young team, and I've read up on it. They hit the woodwork three times before half time. They were very, very dominant. But as a young team, at what point do you, as a coach, do you have to keep on at these young players, whether it's at halftime or during the match, to trust the process, trust the principles, have that patience? It's gonna come, it's gonna happen. Because if it's an older team, a more experienced team, they've gone through this and they trust the coach, they trust the process, they trust the tactics. But these are young footballers. And it's a big, big game away to a big team, a big stadium. What's the mindset that goes through that?
You know what, you're absolutely right. I think that's a cracking question, purely because as I'm watching the game, and I know the score, I know when they score, but you're looking, thinking, are they going to stay in this? Are they going to stay mentally in this? Because, like you said, they hit the woodwork three times. One of the times was Littmanen, whose free kick actually bounced over the line. Clivert had a goal disallowed in the first half as well that looked pretty okay to me. I'm not really quite sure why it was disallowed. And Real Madrid were really, really scratching. They had some kind of openings, but kind of scratching at chances. And if I was Louis van Gaal that night, I am thinking, please score before halftime, because we're sort of way we need it. They can regroup at halftime and use their experience and so on. So the term trust the process is, we think it's quite a new term, but this was 25 years ago now, you know, and this was with a bunch of boys, basically, in football terms. And listen, Ajax is a club where it's built on its principles and it's built on its playing philosophy. So I think all that kind of morphs into, they were European champions as well at the time. So it morphs into, you know, come on, we know what we're doing here. We're doing it on the greatest stage, and they look like they were playing with no fear. Maybe that comes with youth. Maybe you don't have that same anxiety when you're when you're young and nothing to lose. So yeah, it's you know, a lot of these games, you talk about tactics, but you talk about psychology, and you talk about which way the game flows at a particular point. All Real Madrid needed was a set play, and how often do you see it in our leagues or in youth football, a set play or a counter attack, and they score 1-0 and they win the game, and you think, how has that happened? So yeah, you've got to hand it to the Dutch and to coaches like Van Gaal, who are willing to stick their neck out for what they believe in and for a game that they, you know, they want to play and they want to trust.
Excellent. Well, thanks for that.
Brilliant, cheers, Ray. Right, next game. Barca 1, Inter Milan 0. Now, this was a Champions League match, second leg. Inter Milan won the first leg 3-1. And there was a bit of controversy prior to the game where Pandev, who was named in the starting lineup for Inter, suffered a mysterious injury, and in came Kivu. So already the gamesmanship began between Mourinho and Guardiola. And yes, Inter held out. It was known as a Mourinho masterclass. Pique scored the winner for Barcelona, but Inter held on, and we saw Mourinho celebrating on the pitch when the sprinklers came on.
Yeah. I mean, I use the term winner's history quite a lot when I talk about tactics, because I think ultimately it is the winners who decide how the narrative goes in many ways. For example, the last Champions League game, I think before this lockdown, was Simeone, Atletico Madrid at Liverpool, who Atletico in the first leg, 100% a defensive masterclass. The second leg was, I would suggest, without being too dramatic, was almost a defensive shambles, because of the amount of chances they conceded and stuff like that. And it was kind of the result and the small moments in the game that has it rewritten as you know, a defensive masterclass. If you look at that night, I had to, as a coach, put a game in the top five that was kind of with a defensive angle on it, for sure. And if you want to study how to set up a team to defend, you know, Jose Mourinho away from home is a pretty good place to start, and Jose Mourinho away from home with 10 men is kind of a better place again. Kivu coming in for Pandev. If those who don't remember Pandev, he's a wide forward, very good left foot, a good threat going forward. But and Kivu was a centre half, from what I remember, rather than anything else, who ended up playing on the left wing. And you know, we've got to remember that Barcelona's right hand side at the time was Dani Alves and Messi. So it's a kind of Mourinho, you know, right from his playbook sort of thing to want to kill that side of the game, because they had the lead. You know, before Thiago Motta was even sent off, they had the lead, and they were always going to hang on. Now, what I do love about Mourinho and the relationship he builds with certainly that Inter team. It was probably the closest he got to the Chelsea Porto kind of level of trust with the players. He had, once that sending off happened, he had Eto'o playing Eto'o playing on one side of midfield and Diego Milito playing on the other, who would get into any team as a number nine. Both of them, you know, and they worked. They worked, and they physically worked, and they mucked in. And Wesley Schneider kind of played as the most advanced, whatever that was, fielder, or, you know, trying to get the team up the pitch. But again, there's little moments. Pique scored a wonderful goal, actually. When you look back, it's kind of if Ronaldo scored it would be on every probably highlight reel. And Bojan, if you remember Bojan, he scored a goal that was disallowed, quite near the end. And, you know, if that goal goes in from Bojan, it's 2-0, Barcelona go through on away goals, and we're probably saying that Mourinho was mad, he was too negative, you can't play with strikers on the wings, and, you know, in a defensive team, and Schneider was playing up front on his own, you get a different narrative. So, but to be fair, as a team performance that night, they deserved an Inter. They lost the game, but they won the tie. And again, it probably shows you what you can do with organisation and discipline, and a kind of eye on the team that night.
That's right, and Inter went on to win the Champions League that season, and they gave Bayern a hiding in the final, didn't they?
Correct, yeah, and he left that summer as well, Mourinho, yeah. Which is, I know it's kind of like him riding off into the sunset, isn't it? Did they win the treble that year?
That's correct,
so it's, listen, they weren't a bad team. It's not like they were, like my other kind of go-to park the bus team. It's a really random game. It was Iran played Argentina in the World Cup in 2014 and literally packed the box and lost in injury time. Now, when we talk about moments, they during the second half, they had a penalty, a good penalty shot turned down. And again, you're talking a completely different game if that moment changes. So, Inter weren't, with all due respect, they weren't Iran. They weren't punching up against giants in a game, relatively speaking. They were a good side, but that night he certainly did what he had to do to get through to the final.
Absolutely, Mike. Any questions?
Just really about the mentality for a one-off game like that. I mean, I guess that game is an example where there is still a place for one-off pragmatism and to play the opponent and adjust your tactics accordingly. But I think in that game, Cambiasso, I thought he was just outstanding. He just shackled Messi, physically, an outstanding display. In a game like that, as a coach, as a Barcelona coach, do you then accept if it's going, it's gone to half time, you're on 60 minutes, do you then accept that you're actually playing 10v10 rather than 11v11?
I think that would be, for someone like Guardiola, I think that would have been very hard to accept that night. I'm willing to be wrong on this, but I won't be too far wrong. I believe it was 87% of the ball. I don't think Inter had 100 passes. We're talking from the defensive point of view of Inter being resolute and tactically clever and pragmatic and all that kind of stuff. Barcelona's point of view, they were thinking we were miles good enough to win this game. We did create opportunities and, one decision where the ball ends up in the back of the net, it changes the whole thing. And you think, you remember when Barcelona beat Chelsea at Stamford Bridge? I think it was a draw, but they won the tie. Yeah. And the praise afterwards was, they stuck to their principles. They were struggling, but they stuck at it, they stuck at it, they stuck at it. So if we're going to praise them for doing that at Stamford Bridge, the same, I believe anyway, that the same thing should be granted to them in a game like that, where they stuck to it, they played in their way, they had four proper little guys up top at the end of the game with Bojan, and I think Jefferson might have been in there at that time, I can't quite remember. But it was Pedro was involved, Messi was involved. So it was, they lost very Barcelona-y at the time. But I maintain that you have another moment, and that game, we look back on that totally differently. And what's actually interesting, one of the most interesting things, sorry, about that whole tie is that if you go to research it, and I don't know if you found it when you were checking it, you find a hell of a lot more about the first leg than you do about the second leg, which is, I thought, was really, really quite strange, even though it's worth looking, of course, at the first leg as well. It's winner's history, and they will absolutely feel they deserve to win it, but I think Barca would as well that night.
Next game, fast forward 7 months, and Guardiola has his revenge on Jose Mourinho in emphatic style. Barca 5, Real Madrid 0. And yeah, the one thing I remember most about this game, Ray, was the incredibly high line Real Madrid were playing for the majority of this game. I could not believe it.
Yeah, I couldn't either. Watching it live, to me, this was Barcelona at their Guardiola best. This was, I do purr even when I think about this game. They were they were just Barcelona that night. That is, they were just outstanding. They were absolutely on a different planet. It was, I don't know, if someone ever asked you in 10 years, you know, give me a game, forget about the Champions League final, I think give me a game that shows what they're all about, and it was probably that one. And it was, they crucified Madrid last night. I don't like using kind of non-coaching words to describe games. It sounds more like a commentator's word, but they really did put them to the sword that night. They're really, really clinical. I think it's a game, and if I was to sit down, everything being even, and someone said pick one game to watch, it would be that one. And I'm not a fan of either, necessarily. It's definitely not with a supporter's hat on. But I found you see something different every time you watch it. It's quite... there's so many layers to how Barcelona played at that time. And the first goal, for example, I think it's the first one. You just... As the play builds up... Pedro, I think, pulls Pepe out from centre-half, and you can see it so clearly on the pass then, you know, in true Barcelona fashion, they play the pass beyond Pepe and, you know, playing 100 mile an hour, and they expose it. But you'll like this one. There was the second goal comes from Pedro. Pedro cuts in from the right, and David Villa crosses from the left. But I think Marcelo has fouled Pedro or left one on him, and he's given... Marcelo's given him a bit of lip or whatever, and he turns around, and next thing Pedro's gone, and he's got in front of him, and he scored. So it's the little things you start to pick up the more you watch it makes it a really fascinating.
This game, I think, undoubtedly is probably in Messi's top three in terms of individual performances. He was incredible that night. I'm not saying the rest of the team weren't, but him especially.
Yeah. He didn't score that night, I don't think.
No.
So is that what you were going to say?
Yep.
I was trying to go through really quickly who had scored. I think David Villa got a couple, and Pedro, and I think Jeffrey got the fifth, you know, to proper rub salt in it. I don't have a clue where he is now. He could be somewhere great. He seems to have fallen off the edge of the football world.
He might be playing in Cyprus for all we know, because that's where a lot of...
it's not a bad choice either, is it? No, but you're absolutely right. Messi was outstanding. There's a couple of passes. I think that there was a pass for, I think it was David Villa's second goal, in particular. That was kind of, you know, we think about Messi as a winger or a goal scorer or inside forward, but he's the best central midfield player ever. Surely, you know, in terms of some of the spaces he picks up and the technique he has to open teams up like he does there. Maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit, but you're right. He was outstanding that night, and his skill set is through the roof in so many different ways. But as a team performance that night, it's definitely a go-to game for me to kind of brush up and touch up my knowledge of. That's Guardiola method.
Brilliant. Well, before Mike asks his question, Jeffren is at Slaven Belupo in Croatia.
He was in Ajax, wasn't he? Didn't he play for Ajax as well in Cyprus?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I think he did, because you mentioned Cyprus. I thought, I'm sure he played for Ajax. I haven't got the...
What, after Barca? Possibly.
Nothing. I don't know, but yeah, here we go. I've got it. Found it. Yeah, he was at Ajax. Played a few times.
I can't believe it. Oh my goodness!
Yeah. Buy a lottery ticket, mate, because you've landed on one there.
Wow. Okay. It's still Stradamus. Thank you very much. Sorry. Yes, Mike. Sorry, mate.
Yeah. No. Just. I mean, in a game like this, obviously, all you know, the Barcelona team were probably. All 9 out of 10, 10 out of 10 players, but at the highest level, Ray, and you know you've coached at a high level. You're a UEFA licensed coach. How much does it need for an opposition to drop their level for a team where there is a certain balance? But this was very, very one-sided. I mean, how much do marginal gains play in a match like this, where it's so one-sided, where one team is so dominant, where ordinarily these teams are pretty even. And if I remember rightly, weren't this Madrid team, they were unbeaten up to that point?
I think you are right. And I think it was, I can't remember the month, I think it was even before Christmas. I think it was for the first Clásico Mourinho was involved in. And that's another storyline as well, that the other context is that Mourinho was brought in to end this Barcelona kind of march to the title every year and to slow down this machine. And arguably, maybe over time he did that, but it certainly wasn't a good start. And do you know what? As a coach, I think Mourinho played with fire that night because, Stel, you mentioned the high line they played. It kind of, you know, if it was me stood in that dugout, you know, Xabi Alonso or Pepe or Sergio Ramos, they're not listening to me anymore. No way. Mm-hmm. They're not listening to a thing I ever say again because it went so wrong tactically that night and kind of, I don't know, it's the best they could do, and he did this a lot in the class, because the best they could do often to lay a proper glove on them was to turn the game a little bit nasty. And you know, I know Pepe played in midfield before and they used to take it in turns to kick Messi and all that sort of stuff. Carvalho played that night as well. Believe it or not, it's one of them signings you forget ever happened, that Carvalho at Madrid. So you know, it was impressed, I guess, with Mourinho that he survived that so easily and then was relatively successful at Madrid, because they looked like, they just looked like a badly set up team that never really had a chance at it and never had a go at the game.
Okay.
Yeah, it's like what you said about the players not listening to Jose Mourinho. He went to Real Madrid, big reputation obviously, and I think the first thing he did was fall out with Raul and Casillas and Sergio Ramos, and those are the three players who at the time were the kings of the club. You wouldn't want to upset them, really.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's maybe that forthrightness is good, and maybe that's he obviously stuck to his guns and it was needed or whatever it was. My point was being he's actually done well to survive all that, and especially that game, because there's not too many managers that can go to Real Madrid and be not just thumped on the scoreline but kind of picked apart quite readily. And you know, Barcelona are really enjoying themselves. We've probably all played in games where we've just enjoyed ourselves because it was you know, we felt like we had more space than anyone else. And you're right about that high line. It was like every time I had a little bit of time and space, I could play a forward pass and probably hurt them. And it just really did look like they were playing a different game to Madrid that night. And seeing, you know, this Madrid's idea that we're getting Mourinho in here to play catch up. And to catch these guys, it looked far further away than ever. So you know, it's quite impressive how he survived it. But that night, certainly, knowing Jose, he would have banked that. I'm certain to bring out another time.
One more thing on Mourinho. Can he turn things around at Spurs? Because a lot of people are questioning his ability. They say that he's dated, his methods are archaic. Is it the same situation as with Van Gaal at United, where he didn't have the players or doesn't have the players to play his system, or is he just unlucky with injuries?
I don't know, because I don't know if you'd ever, I don't know if you could write off this guy, because I think I don't know. He was so good, so good for so long, to the point where he kind of made football management quite stylish, and you always, whether you loved him or hated him or didn't like him or, you know, anything like that, you wanted to hear what he said, and you felt like he knew something that you didn't know all the time. It felt like every time he said something that had a different meaning, and you were trying to catch up with his thought process. And that doesn't leave you, you know, that maybe your shape or your experiences. And what we forget, and what everyone forgets quite a lot, is that Porto team he had were outstanding in their ability and in terms of their style. He's not always been this park the bus and counter-attack and be big and ugly and all that sort of stuff. And what I was hoping for, and I'm not a Tottenham fan, I was really gutted actually to see Pochettino leave, because I really like watching his teams, and thought he bridged the gap there that Tottenham weren't able to bridge for years and years. And it just didn't feel like it. Like, it still doesn't feel like it's the right fit. I may be proven absolutely wrong here. He might go into the rest of the season or whatever happens next year and so on, and look to enjoy the game rather than battle through, which he feels like he's done for the last few years, and maybe he does turn around. But you know, that's the rot was setting in a little bit before he arrived, to be fair. Players wanting to leave and probably ran their cycle, so it's going to happen there. But you know, if I was sat having dinner with Jose Mourinho and he said he had a plan, I'd believe him for sure. Wouldn't you?
Absolutely, mate, absolutely. Okay, last but not least, the game that means a lot to you: Bohemians under 19-4, Waterford under 19-3.
Yeah, this is, you know, the football fan is listening to this going, what's this guy on about? This has gone too far, you know. And this was probably, going back to your earlier question about Ancelotti and what he would have changed. We played, I'll give you some context, I was head coach of the Waterford under-19s. This was the quarterfinals of the Cup. We were playing Bohemians. They had just played in the Champions League against Michelin. I can never quite say that team properly, but I'm quite happy with that. the context of the game was, we were playing them away from home. We had lost 5-0 to them in an earlier cup competition a few months previously. They just played in the Champions League, and were probably the best team in the country at the time. And we, first half, I'll give you the kind of short synopsis. First half we were second best. We liked to play with the ball and didn't see hardly as much of it as we wanted to, but we did go 1-0 up, and it went 1-1, and then we did go 2-1 up, and then one of those moments that I've been talking about the whole call, one of those moments changed everything, which was a debatable penalty for Bose just before half time, and a straight red for our goalkeeper for something he said. So you had all that, you know, so okay, they scored the penalty, it's 2-2, it's about a minute till half time. You've got a kid, a proper kid, sub goalkeeper come on. The twin brother of the goalkeeper who was sent off, I took off in the game. So I had one brother sent off, the other one taken off before half time, just get the proper goalkeeper on. So not a good family day for those guys. And kind of a lot of head scratching and a lot of, you know, what do we do now? So we went in at half time, and bear in mind this had just happened before half time, and the crowd that were there were quite emotional, and the players were quite emotional, and you were trying to be calm and clear and thoughtful and what have you. I remember asking one of the support staff there just to give me and the kind of football staff, just give us 5 minutes. It was actually our strength and conditioning guy. Just go in, just settle them down, let them have a drink, let them moan if they need to, see if they're injured or if they need, you know, whatever. And just give us some breathing space to kind of figure out. And looking back on that game now, we actually went 2-1 up. We went 3-2 up soon after halftime with 10 men. And we were struggling in this game anyway to get the ball. We scored from a kind of pre-rehearsed set play, which was lovely. But it was from that moment, I had my Ancelotti moment, where I know now what I should have changed. And I know now what I should have done at halftime in preparation to change. I replay that game over and over in my mind based on those changes all the time. We conceded a goal to make it 3-3. That came precisely from, so for example, I know it's very hypothetical over the phone, but I would have went 5 at the back and killed the kind of what they call a half space in our box, and their equaliser came from there, and it was only a matter of time really. We were punch drunk by the end, physically. It was only a matter of time. They won it quite late actually, So we kind of had a moral victory, and then we could claim victim a little bit from the sending off and so on, and kind of a gallant defeat. But I look back on it very much with my coach's hat on and going, yeah, if that happens again, if those circumstances present themselves, this is my template. So I'm now going to call it my Ancelotti moment, because I never thought about it. I never connected those dots. So I'll remember you forever for that, Mike.
Well, what did you say to him at full time?
Do you know what? There's another connection here, because we were... It was more than losing a game, because it was also you're out of the cup, so that was the end of quite a lot of the boys' journey in youth football. The next kick of the ball they would play would be in senior men's football, be it professionally or not. So it was kind of the team was disbanding as much as anything, and they're sore. I do remember, and usually this wouldn't absolutely not happen in a team I run, but parents came on the pitch, and I think it was, I vividly remember a sister cuddling a lad who was in tears, and you kind of go, do you know what, this is one of them that, you know, you shake their hands, you tell them well done. I apologise to the lad for taking him off. I said nothing to the goalkeeper about his sending off for another 2 or 3 weeks until we sat down together again, because it's just not the right time. It's just not the right time or the right moment. I told them I was proud of them. Then on the way home, I decided to come up with my master plan to actually win the game that was already lost. So, that'll live long in the memory, to be fair.
How far do you think you guys would have gone had you got through?
I think we were right in the mix after that. We were young, so... We were under 19, but it's a 2-year age band. So we were quite young. We were probably about 70% under 18, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I never did kind of see that group up until the following year. But I think it would have given us great... We didn't play very well that day. And, you know, I believe looking back, that's a different set of circumstances, and we would have found a way to win that game and probably not played as bad ever again. But look, I'd love to sit here and say we would have, could have won it. There was one point separated the top three in our league when all was said and done. So, you know, you're talking really small margins, I guess. And youth football, it's about more than that, but at that age, you can be more tactical and look to win and what have you. It was a good group. It was an enjoyable season, and we outperformed probably. We were probably a mid-table group, so we kind of could play with a little bit more freedom than when you're expected to. It's generally the Dublin-based teams that are the strongest in Ireland. Whereas we were, quite a regional club. So, we're really proud of what we did that year. And maybe losing that game, dare I say, benefits you more in the long run. I don't know, if we'd won that game, I'm probably not thinking about it anymore. So, or thinking about it in a different way,
Yeah, I understand.
So, yeah.
Brilliant. Gary?
Just simply, how many of those players went on to play professionally and had a longish career? And do they themselves ever cite this game as part of their learning process?
I'm trying to think of the second year players, so the older players who would have been involved in that group. One of them stands out as, this was 2018, so it's still quite reasonably recent. Considering what's happened with the virus, it's doubly... kind of difficult. You're probably talking the same percentages as you're speaking about in England, and that's there's one that plays in the Waterford first team. If you Google Shane Griffin, actually he scored a worldie in front of the TV cameras in the first team. But he was I always fancy Shane go to England, but it's that's life in football sometimes. With a few others that would have played underage for Ireland that would be playing in Division 1 in Ireland now as well, and some of them that would drop back to look your football. So it's kind of a similar story, to be fair. These lads can be on the verge of... We had one boy that went over to Celtic, which at 18 is quite old. So, you know, you're one performance or one decision away from signing for Celtic to pretend another decision coming back to Waterford and just to get something there. So it's, these things are really on the knife edge. You know how it goes. And really is only the top percent that survive it and become pros. A few of them went to America, to be fair. There's other, we should just think about the pro contracts, we should think about the other exit routes. Some of them are coaches, all that. But listen, if I was to talk to the goalkeeper and he didn't carry that learning lesson from that game, I'd probably fall out with him. And I said I wouldn't swear, didn't I, at the start of this? Well, I would definitely fall out with him taking that game with him.
No. One question from me, Ray. Final one. Was this what year was this match, by the way?
2018. So it was a summer season in Ireland. So it would have been, I guess, October.
Right.
October. Yeah.
Okay. So okay, I might get this completely wrong, but did you have a player called Ali Regba playing there?
No.
No. Okay. Because there's a lad that I know. His name's Ali Regba. He plays for Leicester. He's in the under 23s, and he was at Bohemians. 2018-2019 season.
Okay.
He's German-born, but he's Algerian heritage. But the lad is just, he's a powerhouse. You know how Karim Benzema was when he broke onto the scene at Lyon? He's got those traits. He's looking really good, really good. And he's chosen the Republic of Ireland as well. That's his national team.
I mean, I said at the start of the call that they were probably that year, or certainly that 2 years, were the most productive youth team in the country. With for their underage stuff, but players in the first team, they would have played Chelsea pre-season and had a 14-year-old playing against Chelsea in the. Mm-hmm. It was kind of made headlines over there. It was kind of a bit of a shop window kind of piece of business or whatever. But yeah, they were right. It wouldn't surprise me. They had a lot of first team players that would have played under 19s as their kind of go to, and they were a good side. They were playing Champions League football. You know, they had the pick of Dublin at that time, for the most part. So they were a good side. I couldn't recall a single name other than, you know, if you put a team sheet in front of me, I probably could, but. Don't know the name, but I'll look out for it now.
Yeah, it was at Shelburne before, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
So yeah, he's
very good.
Very, very promising player. Very promising. There you go. Mike, anything else, mate?
Just a quick question about your books, Ray. And I know that I've got one of the books, Rolling the Ball, and I mean, as being a chairman of Sports Club, and the most difficult thing that we have to sort of instill in our managers, but also our parents, especially of the teams, is what you say. You know, you correctly say about it should be development over results. It wasn't always like that. Why are we still in this country obsessed with a results orientated grassroots football, Sunday league football, especially for children, when really, as you quite rightly say in your books, it's the development of these young footballers which is more important?
In my newer book, actually, Coaching Youth Football, I start off with a bit of a revelation I had a few months ago. Just to give you a bit of background, it was actually where I met Thor. We were in Singapore, and I was asked to, I think it was a Monday night, I was tasked with watching the national under-18s play a game. The following morning, I had to put a presentation together to feed back to not only the guys there from Singapore, but 20 other Asian nations who were represented at the thing. And I was putting this presentation together, and talk about being parachuted in, very little context around what I was going to sort of feedback. But I kind of thought to myself, do you know what? If I was I will get around to answering your question, I promise. If I was Guardiola, sure, I would look at this game through my lens. My coaching lens would be, we'll say, around possession football. If I was Mourinho, my lens would be compact. If I was Klopp, I'd be looking at how they pressed and counter-pressed and so on. So we all have our football influences. And we're all shaped by the game we watched, the team we supported, the team we played for, the position we played, everything. I had a dad of an academy kid come to me a couple of years ago and was furious. He could not understand why we didn't play 4-4-2, where one midfielder goes, one midfielder stays, two wingers, two strikers. He couldn't understand it because that was the game he knew. That was the game he understood. So I think we have a role to also understand other people's lenses. Now, chances are that the dads that you speak about that are talking about results all the time, there's every chance that is their only understanding of the game, and that is the scoreline. So regardless, maybe they don't even understand, and I don't mean to be patronising, not for a second, but I'm putting it out there. Maybe they don't even understand what good performance, you know, is dribbling and losing the ball good performance, or is it is kicking it down the pitch and not giving the ball away, is that good performance? And that's hard to figure out when your lens and your experience isn't as kind of youth football orientated as you'd like it to be or I'd like it to be. So I think that comes into it, and parents will just see a result. That's their only vision of football is, you know, we support Man United, we want them to win on Saturday, so we watch our kid on a Sunday morning, we want them to win, and it doesn't really matter how it's done, they win. So that's the big problem in it. If you go over to Spain, it's all about winning. But the thing is, they don't forego everything else for the result. They don't forego the little kids. They don't leave Iniesta on the bench or Xavi on the bench when he's 10 because, you know, he's not big enough or strong enough or fast enough or whatever. So I suppose that the best thing to do was, yeah, go out and win your games or try to win your games, but, you know, do it in a morally developed with your development hat on also. That would be my suggestion.
I guess for us, for me, it's been slightly easier, I guess, with my team that I've currently got, and I've had them since they're under 9 and they're now under 15, is that, you know, being a school teacher is very easy for me at the beginning to say to the parents, look, please trust me with what I'm trying to do with the boys, because you would not come into my classroom and try and teach my class. Please don't come onto my training pitch and try and teach the boys. Yes, you've got your views. Yes, you watch football, but you've entrusted the development of these boys to me, so please give me the opportunity. And just that sentence has allowed me to do what I believe is correct. Mm-hmm. It's not so easy for everyone else because they can't all use that sentence. And that's a tough thing we need to overcome. But as a club, we have got an ethos, we have got a philosophy which we try and espouse. And, you know, developing the boys and equal playing time and, you know, rotation of positions and over a season and things like that at the golden years of development is really important to us. But not everyone buys into it, unfortunately.
Yeah, it's a difficult sell because it's not what they see. It's not what they perceive football to be. And I know it sounds very philosophical, but I really don't mean it to be. I mentor quite a lot of coaches actually that are not just around the UK but around the world, and they'll talk to me a little bit like you've done, and they say to me, "But every other coach I see is doing it a different way. Every other coach I see is screaming at kids. Every coach I see is you know, doing line drills where they're all just, you know, stood in a big long queue and doing passing things. And I know I should be focusing on small sided games. I know I should be quiet, but I feel like I'm not kind of flowing. I'm flowing against the tide. And it's really, really important that you like you said earlier, trust the process. I think it's not even an intervention like you've described because you've done it at the start. But I would highly suggest to any coach who wants to avoid problems with parents is 100% have the same conversation you had at the start. Okay, they can't use the teacher bit, but saying to them, look, we're going to play a particular way, we're going to rotate positions. In fact, if we don't rotate positions, I want you to call me on it. And we'll lose game, but it doesn't really matter to me, and it shouldn't matter to you too much. We don't want our kids beating 10, 12, 15 every week. That's a bad place to be in in many respects. But I think if coaches can have that, take the bull by the horns and have that conversation first, then you negate all the whispering, all the discontentment, all the why is my lad playing as a left back, he's a striker, blah blah blah. I think you can kill that before it starts, and then you might just have to tidy up some little problems, but not a lot.
No, thanks for that, and thanks for your book as well. I think it's great.
No worries, and it's available on Amazon along with all the other books that I've written as well. Yes. I just saw a big plug came out of the sky just to get that.
Do you know what? I always ask our guests at the end if they wanted to plug anything, but you beat me to it.
I'm used to it, mate. Jesus, I'm used to it.
Great stuff. Well, Ray, before I let you go, Twitter handle or anything else you'd like to mention?
Yeah, power_Ray on Twitter. I'm reasonably active on there. I'm a listener as much as a contributor sometimes on Twitter. But my direct messages are always open, so if anyone wants to reach out unless it's daft or stupid, I tend to engage with everyone who does that. By all means, feel free to do it. Really enjoyed it. A lot of we have had the coaching angle tonight for sure, especially with Mike in the room as well. But it's nice to do something a little bit different with those games, and it's been fun actually. Yeah,
fantastic. Glad you enjoyed it, and thanks for jumping on board.
No problem, Gav. Thank you so much.
Great stuff, Mike. Twitter handle, mate.
Yeah, it's DelPieri10.
Anything else?
No, not really. It's been great coming back on the show. I mean, the last few I've done solo with some authors. So, it's been great being on the show back with you still. So, hopefully we can do more.
Oh, that was nice. Nicest thing you said to me in a long time, Mike.
Since yesterday, yeah.
That's right. Well, there you go. For all our listeners or people still listening, you can give us a follow on Twitter at Shoot the Defence. This is... I've lost count of how many podcasts we've done, but if you guys...
51?
Are, huh?
51 or 52, I was looking at them today.
I think I've got some scheduled prior to this one being released, so by the time this one comes out, this will probably be 55, 56. So yeah, 56 in 56 days for those of you listening now. So yeah, there you go. We're consistent.
Super.
We're consistent. Yeah. So until next time.